Bienvenidos a Data Latam, donde exploramos la industria de datos en Latinoamérica.
Muy buenas, Franz, ¿cómo estás?
Muy buenas, Diego, muy bien, muchas gracias. ¿Tú cómo estás?
Bien, 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 bien. Aquí en la tierra de Atenas, vos en San Carlos, lindo clima. ¿Y cómo va? ¿Cómo va esa vida de viajes? ¿Dónde vas próximamente?
Mira, esta vez lo anoté porque la otra vez no recordaba. Voy a estar ahorita en agosto en USR, en Duke University. Aquí dice Atlanta, pero eso no es Atlanta. ¿Ves? Exactamente, ni anotándose dónde voy, qué horror. Ojalá entre el avión que sea. En septiembre voy a estar en el Rust Conference y eso va a ser en Seattle. Y en septiembre también vamos a estar varios de nosotros en el POSIT Conference en Atlanta, ese sí en Atlanta. Entonces, mucho viaje, pero va a ser muy divertido. Hay tanto pasando en el mundo de datos, en el mundo de AI. Ya tenemos AI tradicional, AI generativo. Hay muchas cosas donde vale la pena hablar con gente, ver en qué están.
Yo agrego, voy a estar con vos en el POSIT Conference, voy a estar en Brasil en noviembre con algunas cosas interesantes que están pasando en el mundo de datos en Brasil, así que más noticias pronto. Y bueno, hablando de lo que decías, ¿no? De lo que está pasando en el mundo de datos, datos, startups, gente inteligente pensando en ideas interesantes, usando datos relevantes para generar valor a clientes. Y hoy, por suerte, tenemos a un cofundador de una empresa que se llama Soil Benchmark, que va a contar su historia de datapreneurship, ¿no? Como nos gusta decir con Franz. Va a ser en inglés, así que, with that, go for it, Franz.
With that being said, Ben, Ben Butler, welcome to the Data Latam podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here, Ben. And usually we start with, where are you now? So that the audience gets an idea of, yeah, where in the world is Ben Butler?
So, yeah, I work from Dublin, actually. I'm based just south of Dublin, but the company I work for are based in the UK. So I'm between Ireland and the UK, which is where I'm originally from.
Fantastic. And then the other context question we like asking is, what's your role in the company? We're going to get to the company and everything, but what's your role? What's your...
Yeah, so well, I'm a co-founder of Soil Benchmark, and I guess my official title is CSO, Chief Science Officer. And that kind of stems back to my past as a soil scientist. I was very much from an academic background. So I'm still in charge of ensuring that everything we do in our company is based on science and is accurate. But a big part of my role is also product side as well. So
we're going to get there. By the way, you are, I think, the first chief science.
Yeah.
We had chief data officers, yeah, but chief science is even cooler. I like it. I think it's fantastic. So look, let me get to quickly your background as I read it in LinkedIn. But the idea is I'm going to go super fast and then you're going to correct all the mistakes I make because we want to get your story on how you got into this world, right? So I see that you've been in Bangor for a while, since 2008 to 2016, first getting your Bachelor of Science in Ocean Science, also cool. Then your Master of Science from 2011 to 2012 on Environmental Chemistry. And then your PhD in Ocean Science, also in Bangor, from 2012 to 2016, right? So that's the academic side. You're going to then add all the color you want. And then luckily, your story as your experience goes from barista, which is awesome. I here have my coffee. Next time I'm in Ireland, yeah. I know that I have a good coffee there with you. Other than being a barista for a while you were studying, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
You were a research scientist with the James Hutton Institute from 2016 to 2021. And then in 2022, you co-founded and now you're the chief science officer of Soil Benchmark. So please tell us what's...
Yeah, yeah. So like you said, yeah, I was studying at this university, a small university in the UK called Bangor. And I did my undergrad, my master's and my PhD there. I was there for like 7 years. And it was all focused around, most of it was focused around ocean science and marine chemistry. I was very much interested in that. And my PhD was on like marine geochemistry. And yeah, it just satisfied my curiosity and got me to the point at which I'd kind of finished taken education as far as I could, and eventually then had to get a job in the world.
There are a lot of reasons why people may like the ocean, right? But what was it exactly? What was the tipping point that got you into?
I was always just, as a kid, well, it kind of stemmed from my love for surfing as a kid. I was a real keen surfer as a teenager, and I just followed my love for the ocean from there and studied ocean science. Initially, I was thinking, oh, I'm just going to be studying waves and surfing stuff. And then it turned out I was actually more interested in the chemistry of the ocean and the way nutrients cycle around marine systems, which not many people in the department were. So I was kind of, there wasn't much competition for in that kind of research group. And there was loads of other exciting opportunities that I was able to get involved in, such as that PhD that I ended up doing, which was great. And I have very fond memories of doing a PhD. I loved it. And then I was fortunate enough to move from there into like a postdoc position up in Northeast Scotland, a research institute there. And it was there where I moved from ocean science to soil science. And the link there was, it was still like, in my PhD, I was doing like marine geochemistry and mineralogy. And then this postdoc position was in like soil geochemistry and mineralogy. So a lot of like the analytical techniques were similar. But this was a really important change that led me to where I am now, because I basically had this like 3-year postdoc position where I had the freedom to like take my research where I wanted to. And I had the time to really learn programming. So it was the first time I really got stuck into a programming language, because I was dealing with quite large data sets of soil data from around the world. And it quickly became apparent that I needed to do stuff beyond an Excel spreadsheet. And I chose R to do that because R is just the default programming language in academia, particularly in environmental science. I guess Python is default in other parts of academia, like bioinformatics. But in environmental science, where I was, R was the obvious choice. So then I just like got stuck in and ended up spending like probably the best part of 5 years just working in R every day and doing data analysis and building Shiny apps as well to like help me with my work and help me communicate my work. And for a while, looking back now, the apps I was creating were incredibly simple and didn't really do much. And I didn't really appreciate that I was actually developing software. But I have that. And that's kind of like, that was the stepping stone to being able to take on this role in Soil Benchmark and initially lead on building all the building our product, basically, which we'll, I guess, move on to.
Yeah, sure. So before you tell us how you got into Soil Benchmark, what was the origin story there? Co-founder stories are always fun.
Yeah, this is a funny one. So yeah, Tom and I, Tom's my co-founder, we met through this small conference organized by the early careers section of the British Society of Soil Science. So it was a very, very niche area. And he was at the conference just like learning and kind of scoping out this idea that he had to set up a company that made something that made better use of soil data or used soil data to help people make decisions. So he's from a farming background and is interested in soils and sustainable food production. So we just spoke about this idea while I was there as a soil scientist presenting work. And we spoke a couple of times about it. And then it just so happened that year I ended up leaving my job as a soil scientist because my wife got a job in Ireland where I am now. And I left it to move here. So and I didn't have any job to go to. It was just like a bit of a leap of faith that something interesting will come along. And in that time, Tom actually went ahead and set up Soil Benchmark and got it off the ground and into like got a grant to cover like to do some initial groundwork and got on a startup accelerator program. And then he got in touch with me when he realized I'd left my job and was like, let's chat. And yeah, that's how I ended up coming on board. So that was like 3 years ago, on the 1st of August. So, and yeah, lots happened since then.
So it's almost your holiday for the company. What do you do? What does Soul Benchmark do? Can you describe it briefly?
Yeah, so it's evolved into a product that helps mainly like farming consultants do some very specific jobs around soil management and nutrient management and manure management. So these are all jobs that are designed to help farms manage their soils in a more sustainable way, to like stop them washing away, blowing away, or waterways becoming polluted because you've applied too much fertilizer or too much manure. So there are these like particular jobs that advisors in the UK have to do like year on year for each farm that they represent. And through like lots of conversations with them in the very early days, when we were trying to work out what Soil Benchmark was going to become, it became apparent that there was like a consistent need for something in this space, particularly around soil management, because there was this new scheme in England where farms were eligible for money if they had this like soil management plan document. And the guidance for that like particular job without technology to solve it would result in a job that literally took like days to complete, because for every field on a farm you have to identify its slope, if it's near a waterway, if it's well, the soils that it's on, if it's in a high risk area, all these things that you could do manually, but it would literally take you days of work. And I kind of looked at that and realized that with existing data sets that we have in the UK and a bit of technology like an R-Shiny app, you could solve that job in like minutes or instead. So like you could solve it in a way that was like orders of magnitude faster than any other offering. So that's what, when we realized that, we basically set out to build the app to do that. So it relies on a lot of geospatial data. We serve like national scale map layers for the whole of the UK, where we know the risks from which we can work out all of these risk layers for every single field. And because it was like quite a new job, where there was like this clear link between doing that job and getting money from the government, it really helped the uptake. So since we launched it like 2 years ago, it's grown to serve like 10% of the UK, of England's agricultural land at the moment. So it's worked really nicely, and we're now extending it to do other jobs beyond soil.
So it's nice. You got from the ocean to the soil and build this company, and now it's, it's growing interestingly. I mean, 10% of the farmers in England, that's a lot. I was going to ask you, what is the source data that you use? Where is this data coming from? Is this open data that the government has? Is this, how do you enrich this data? If you could talk a little bit about the data.
Yeah, so we're lucky in that like quite a lot of it is open government data. And it was, in a way, it was perfect timing when we launched it, because the government in England had just funded a massive LIDAR survey of the whole of the country and released very high quality LIDAR data for the whole of England, a 1 meter resolution. And from that, there's all sorts you can derive from the LIDAR data, such as slope and the way water accumulates and slope length. And it's really like a critical layer to have in geospatial work. So it just so happened that that became available when we wanted to set this up. And then beyond that, there's a few other open government data sets for like sensitive areas. And then we have a couple of arrangements with data providers for water and soil types. So they're like licensed data sets from Ordnance Survey, which is like the UK's national mapping organization, and British Geological Survey, which, yeah, as the name suggests, deals with all our geology over here. So it's a combination of the two, but wherever possible, we try and lean on open data sets.
Look, I just want to thank you, because you just have justified 5 years or more of my life. I was in the open data space. I started a company called Junar that was helping governments open data. It went really well for a while. Then, I don't know, I want to get into politicians, but Trump got into power, and then open data was not a thing anymore. But then seeing companies like yours being able to provide all the value that you provide, via open data, and the UK has always been very forefront on this, and they used SECAN as the platform and a lot of open data. So, look, thank you for being doing what you're
yeah,
doing.
I think geospatial in particular is an industry where there's kind of leading the way in open data, and not just the data, but also the tools to work on that data. It's really like exciting space to be working in.
Okay, great. So you mentioned data now. You mentioned Shiny for a while. It would be great to let the audience get into some projects, things that you do with this data and that you process this data, how you process this data. So could you take us with one or two projects that you work on? Because, by the way, as a context, we love the idea of the concept of these datapreneurs, right? So data-first companies that start because there is data value that can be transformed from raw data sets into value to end customers. But there's a lot of work in there. It's not just getting the data and then it appears. Yeah. So we want to get into the details of what are the things that you do with this data? How do you do it? Which stack? So anything that you can provide would be of great help for the audience.
Yeah, okay. I'll give a couple of examples. I think the first one I'll give is like probably one of like the key reasons why our platform was so easy to use, and probably one of the things people are most impressed with when they go to our platform. So basically it's the way we allow farms to be added to a system. So my thinking going back a couple of years was that this should be like as easy as possible. As like, ideally all you'd need to do is put in like a number and we do like everything else, and then puff, you're like, your maps are there and everything is in place. And we were able to do this. And the way we did it was, I'll describe the way it works. So basically in the UK, we have this, for every farm in England, at least, they have this 9-digit number, which is linked to like a government API for their field boundaries. So it describes their farm geospatially. And if you put that 9-digit number into this government API, you return the field boundaries. So the barrier to entry on our platform is this 9-digit number. And then when they put that in, we get the field boundaries and we clip all of the relevant data for all the risk layers to that set of fields. For example, so for every field, we'll work out what the runoff risk is, what the soil type is. If there's, we'll pull in all the water data that's within 50 meters of the farm. We'll work out all the risk layers that are relevant to the jobs. And then in the space of, I don't know, seconds to minutes, they then see their farm like cut to size with all the data that's relevant for them with them only having like pressed one button, basically. And the way that worked is it leans heavily on a PostGIS database. So while our front end is all in written in R and Shiny, all of that work pretty much goes on the database. I remember writing like geospatial queries to try and do it in R, and it would basically take like hours to process a farm. But whereas when we started leaning on the database, that went from like hours to seconds. So it means we can process all that information it takes about like half a second per field. So for some farms where they've got like hundreds of fields, they might wait like a minute or two. And we to keep them entertained, we put a little game for them to play while they're waiting. So that was like a real technical challenge that was more on like the data side, and the solutions for that were really heavily reliant on PostGIS and a Postgres database.
You mentioned the technical challenges, if you want, which, I mean, make a lot of sense, and we can dive into that. But I was going to ask you, was there an adoption challenge as well? Was this that you were building super easy for these consultants to use or the farmers to use, or did it take a lot of effort for them to be able to learn how to use it? And was that a challenge? If you could talk about, I mean, sometimes we build great data products, but then people that ought to use it are not being able to. And that's,
I think we were quite lucky with, because this is geospatial data, we can rely very heavily on a map. And maps make a great UI by default. So I basically made the decision very early on that pretty much our whole UI should be based on the map. in which case it already looked kind of good. We just had a map and a few buttons. And because early on, the platform didn't really do that much, it was quite easy for it not to be like an overwhelmingly complicated user interface, because we had the map, users could click fields, and there were a couple of buttons that they could press to edit, write some notes or edit risk layers and create a report. But ultimately, leaning heavily on like an interactive map has really, really helped us. And initially, we were dependent on Leaflet, which has been around for a while. It's you see it all over the place for interactive mapping. But in the past year, we moved to Mapbox, which just took it up a level. So things just render better. It's just like way, it's just like a level beyond Leaflet for speed and the way in which it's polished off with all these like dynamic elements of rendering and styling, etc. The challenge for us is, as the platform has grown, is that as the functionality increases, that's when it really becomes hard to make it keep it intuitive. Because in the early days, when you've only got three buttons to press, like people, you don't really need to tell people where to go. But when now we've got like hundreds probably in the platform, it becomes a real challenge to keep it intuitive. So we've worked quite hard to get that right. And at the moment, our solution is to have like specific modes that you use our platform for specific jobs. And then we update the whole UI to like restrict the user to only the bits that are relevant for their job. So if they're in soil mode, they'll only see the bits that are relevant for like soil management. And if they're in a nutrient mode, they'll only see the bits relevant for nutrient. So that helps keeps things simple. And I'm easily overwhelmed by like UI that's really complicated. So I have a very low tolerance. So stuff like that. So hopefully that will help guide us through these challenges.
So Ben, the stack that you're using, right? What you're building, this, did you stay close to R? And I understand that PostGIS is PostgreSQL, the geospatial variant of it. But is that still what you use? What are you building this with, and how are you extending this?
Yeah. So yeah, the front end is still all in R. It's still an R Shiny app, and it's worked really well for us. It's a great framework for dealing with. Well, building applications that are so heavily reliant on data and manipulate data on the fly. So I think it's, even though it's like quite unusual in the tech space to be like building a product in R and Shiny, like it's actually worked very, very well in our favor. And then we increasingly rely on the database to do things. The main reason for that is it's just so much faster to process data on the database. It's so highly optimized for querying and processing data. My only bugbear with it is I always feel like SQL statements are kind of like written inside out. And yeah. I wish there was like a way you could write SQL with like piped operations, like you can do from R. That's my only bugbear. And we also, aside from that, we have an increasing amount of Python code coming into the code base in like separate APIs that exist in their own repositories, and that's doing things like processing PDFs or listening for database changes and running API calls, etc. And there's Python's, yeah, we've just got a couple of developers that are very clued up on Python and have set up these own services. We have a few different services that our front end depends on, but the front end is still very much a Shiny app.
Good. And in the back end, what is this running on?
So we basically have all of our services running on like Cloud Run environments, not Cloud Run services, on GCP. We use GCP for all our cloud computing. So they're these like containerized services where everything just gets bundled up in a Docker image and deployed super easily. Like, and they're for APIs in particular, they're really scalable. They can like auto scale. You're a bit, Shiny can't make the most of those kinds of things, but in terms of like being able to quickly deploy a Shiny app, with CI/CD as well, and not having too much like DevOps to manage. They've been classed. Oh. And we also have we've been making more and more use of, we've got these cloud run services, which are effectively like serverless VMs or whatever. But we've been making more and more use of cloud run jobs as well. And they're this like slightly hidden alternative to a cloud run service. And they're really interesting because they just allow you to process like a long running task that might take minutes as this like little job that spins up and finishes. We moved a couple of things over to that recently, and it's been a bit of a game changer. So we had that whole adding farm process I described earlier, which could take minutes. That's now a job. So when the user from our front end goes to add a farm, it sends off this job to be done in a Cloud Run job service, and then our front end just repeatedly polls to see whether that job's finished. Whereas before, we'd set it up as an API, and you'd have this like long hanging API that could be waiting for like 5-10 minutes for really large farms. And in Shiny, that takes up some really important like compute space. So the jobs have been really cool, and we want to lean more and more heavily on those.
Great. So what do you see in the sort of in the immediate future, right? In what you're doing in this space that you're working in? What methods, technologies, what are you expecting to see in the next few years?
So in our industry, like there's a lot of talk about in like agri-tech and the agriculture in general. There's a lot of talk about AI, but it's consistently like not really founded on anything useful. Like those conversations, it's just like AI is coming, but I haven't really seen many great examples of benefits to our customers, be it farmers or advisors yet. So those kind of things remain to be seen. But from like a team and like developers perspective, we're already like trying to make use of AI assistance. And we're all using Cursor now for our development. And yeah, I've been amazed at the increase in productivity, things like that. Can bring. It's a really exciting time to be a developer. Like for $30 a month, you can get like, I don't know, 10-20% increase in productivity. And so it's a real bargain. I guess the challenge is not falling into the realms of vibe coding and having no idea what code you're committing into the code base. But our developers seem to be people that really like to make sure they understand all the code that they're committing. So we haven't fallen into that trap yet. And I think from like a development team perspective, I imagine in the next couple of years, we'll eventually reach a point where we're literally calling background or like AI agents to take a prompt and do a background task that changes all the code and creates the pull request. And then we only come into the workflow at the point of reviewing code. And then the role of being a developer or anyone technical in the team becomes like more editorial, I guess. And we'd be like, yeah, juggling numerous other like AI developers. So I think it's going to change so much. So it's a really exciting time. And I think if we don't like get up to speed on all this stuff, we'll just be left behind by teams that do so.
How are you preparing for that, right? Because we live that as well, of course, in our day to day. But are you, beyond just using Cursor, are you doing anything to prepare yourself for that future? Maybe in the way that you write and manage requirements, or the way that you're implementing code reviews now, so that you prepare for code reviews in the future. How are you doing that?
Yeah, I haven't quite worked that out yet, because at the moment we're not quite at the stage where we've actually got AI like doing the whole job. We're very much at like the stage where Cursor's just giving us a helping hand along the way. So yeah, I've tried to like introduce a couple of like kind of workflows for our code reviews, when particularly in the kind of like realm we're at, where we're like innovating quite a lot and we're developing lots of like large new features, where sometimes you just can't avoid having like massive code reviews that are like hundreds or into like the low thousands of lines of code to review. And I've tried to introduce things in the team, such as like almost like an introduction. And whenever someone commits a really big pull request for review, they basically have to have a conversation with whoever's going to review it, and like literally like just give a high level summary of what they've done, why they've done it, and also any like bits they've learned that will be really useful, bits of knowledge that they've learned from that large bit of work that they want to transfer to the team. Because I think in those cases where you have large numbers of changes, you're in a strange position where you've got a high likelihood of the developer having learned something new that could be really useful to the team, but also a very low likelihood that would be detected by the person reviewing, because there's so much has changed and it just gets lost in all the lines of code. So I think just in making sure that there's a lot more opportunity for like conversational challenge and communication between developers when we're doing larger pull requests. And I imagine with AI assistance, you're more likely to be able to get to those larger pull requests, because you've got someone or some sort of agent that can write hundreds of lines of codes in seconds.
Ben, you talked about using the, I mean, we liked at Expantia talking about traditional AI and Gen AI, right? And the new, if you want, the new thing. You talked a lot about the use of this Gen AI internally for Soil Benchmark, for the development team. Have you had any thoughts about uses of Gen AI facing customers for the product and towards?
Yeah. So end users? There's this really cool one that we've actually released recently, where we have this, like, we're in this weird position in the industry we're in, where farms will send off their, like, so they have to get their soils analyzed like every few years for a range of properties. Like they need to know the nutrient levels and the pH and increasingly carbon concentrations for a number of reasons. But they basically send off these soil samples to labs, and they receive their results back in historically, they receive their results back in a PDF format. So you can get them in Excel format or CSV format, but the industry standard that everyone's just familiar with are these PDFs. So we have all this like soil data sitting in PDF format. It's still the norm, and all the historic data is in this format. And it contains all this amazing soil data that is really hard to extract into a platform like ours where they depend on it. So we built this AI like PDF reader, which takes one of these PDF soil results reports, and it will strip out all the relevant data for the soil properties and spit it out in a structured form. So we built it into this. This is one of the Python APIs that we've built. So it's at the moment we've built it around one of these like routine labs that spit out a standard report. And one of the things that it's had to do is link field names from our platform to field names that are on these reports, and they're always different. There's like always spelling mistakes. There's always there's always like slight nuances in the way the fields are named. Like field, like upper field might be renamed top field. Stuff like this that you just can't do with. You can't like. It would be incredibly difficult to catch all these differences with regex. It'd be a nightmare. But we realized that you get AI was actually very good at working out what the field from the report probably is on our platform, with if it has a list of the names that it can choose from. So it's doing that kind of thing, and it's also stripping out all this structured data from a very unstructured PDF. Like it was never designed to be read by a computer. So that's really cool, and we've shown people that functionality, and they've literally been like blown away. They're like, that's unbelievable, because they have to, our users spend so much time like reading these reports and typing in the numbers for every soil property, and it's just like total like time killer. So it's really exciting bit of tech that we've created for this like really this particular problem in our industry.
I have so many questions about that, Ben, but I think we don't have the time. Diego, is there a last question that you want to make today?
I mean, let's do another podcast any other day, but yeah, let's go to the question about, yeah, go for it.
So Ben, data validation is the first thing that comes to mind. Because as you extract data, yes, but how do you make reasonably sure that the structured data you get out of that PDF is actually the values that are there?
Yeah, we strip it from the PDF and then we show it back to the user.
There's user validation.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So there's a human in the loop.
Yeah. So the PDF gets uploaded from our front end. This API that will process it and return it as like a data frame. And then we show that data frame in like an editable table in the front end just to make sure that they can reassign it to a field if it's actually picked the wrong one or it's somehow got the wrong value from it. So it's all editable in the front end. And ultimately the user signs it off.
Understood.
Lovely, lovely. Look, given time, Ben, we'll ask you the usual final question that we ask, which is, there's a lot of things going on. I think that data for soil and improving how we grow food and everything, there's a lot going on. And probably being a startup, you know, you have to be in the forefront. So what are the mechanisms that you have or that you use in order to be able to know what's going on, what's the latest? Be state of the art.
Yeah, to be honest, LinkedIn, I've probably got a lot out of LinkedIn over the last few years by following the right people in the area. There's so many to name, but like for instance, one really good example would be this academic based in the States called Kyle Walker. He developed this like wrapper around Mapbox, an R package, which is essentially a wrapper around Mapbox that allows you to embed Mapbox objects and in a Shiny app. So he released this like a year and a half ago as a open source project. And just knowing about that through LinkedIn meant that we were one of the first like users to start working with it when it was in very, very early release. And we ended up moving our whole front end over to Mapbox via this approach. So just by being on LinkedIn and following him, I knew about that. And another example would be like Andres Quintero, your colleague. I followed him on LinkedIn and heard about this faucet load balancer that he had developed. And we now rely on that for our load balancing in our front end, which has been great and led to loads of interesting work between us and Andres and the team. So like those two like game changing examples that I've just got from LinkedIn alone. And if I hadn't been on there, would still be stuck in Leaflet, I imagine, and not load balancing properly. So those two people, other people that are just more general are, I guess, thought leaders like Hadley Wickham and Albert Rapp actually has been very useful, given some really good tidbits over the years. But yeah, LinkedIn, it seems to be LinkedIn's the place for me at least. And there's loads of people there to follow.
And I have to add, by the way, Ben, that going to conferences, there you can find...
I haven't been one to go to like any like development. I go to like a lot of like agri-tech conferences, but one of the big ones here for agriculture is called Groundswell. And that's great, but it's not for like technical stuff. USAR is also on my list of things to go to. I think I don't speak very good Spanish, but it sounds like Franz was there from his introduction earlier. Maybe next year if it's in Europe, I'll be going there. And I also like try and go on the odd course for like geospatial development every so often. I'm going to one in September organized by Open Geo Hub, which are this like foundation for open source geospatial data based in the Netherlands. So they're organizing a week-long course on open source geospatial tech, which looks class. I can't wait. I definitely need to lean more on the conferences.
And I was kidding basically because all this got started as you and Tom met in a conference, and then I think
Ah, I see what you mean.
No, fantastic that what you added on the conferences that you're going. Look, Ben, this was awesome, but we usually want to keep it to capsules of not more than 40 minutes, but this was awesome. Great getting the story of someone that got from the academic side, if you want, and then being able to get into starting a company like this and what you're doing, high impact, relying a lot on open data, but then doing a lot. This is a fantastic story of that should inspire a lot of entrepreneurs that are seeing this type of opportunities. So, yeah, thanks so much for the time. This is of great value to the community.
Thanks for having me. It's been great to talk.
Until next time, then. Thank you, Ben.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Gracias por acompañarnos en nuestra exploración del mundo de ciencia de datos en este Data Latam Podcast. Cada dos semanas encontrarás un nuevo episodio en datalatam.com o iTunes. Si te gustó este podcast, déjanos comentarios en Facebook.